Well, there is so much material that we have to go through tonight that I will begin immediately, and I'm sure that your experience will also contribute in the end to what I have to say. I want to begin really not directly with the subject, but with some observations on the spiritual dimension in human beings and in human societies. More and more research has shown that this spiritual dimension is innate to human beings. It is deeply wired in one way or another. For many years I was interested in the work of the Alistair Hardy Institute in Oxford. And one of the tasks of this institute was to discover the nature of spiritual experience in people, especially, of course, in England in this context. And many of their findings were quite surprising. For instance, they discovered that immediate spiritual experience is quite common amongst working men, as they put it then, in England. Now, those who know working men in England will be surprised by that, as I was. But nevertheless, it has been shown to be the case. Similarly, David Hay and his associate Kate Hunt, in their work in the University of Nottingham, have shown that people who have no connections with organized religion nevertheless have a lively spirituality. Quite often they are these people are unable to articulate that spirituality because there is no tradition for them to assist them in doing so, but what cannot be denied as a result of this research is that there is this spirituality. Similarly, work with children by David Hay and Rebecca Nye in the University of Cambridge has shown that children are naturally spiritual and that quite often it is adults who drive their spirituality out of them. Robert Coles in the United States has done similar work from a psychiatric point of view. The reason I mention this is that personal spiritual experience is very important for people. It gives them meaning and significance in their lives and gives their lives direction as often as not. But of course, my main concern tonight is not, unfortunately, with personal spiritual experience, but with the spiritual as social manifestation. And it is in that sense that it begins to be called religion, of course. The very word suggests what binds people together. And it is true that religion has been at the very foundations of most societies, all societies, perhaps we can say, until the modern period certainly, and has been the underlying factor in the emergence of societies, in the customs, the values, the laws that many societies have had. And it has provided, as the name suggests, the cohesive force, the glue that sticks society together. It is only recently that sociologists have begun to say that this is no longer true of certain societies. So the British School of Sociologists, for example, characterized by someone like Brian Wilson, have said that democracy and the welfare state now provide the roles that religion used to provide for society. So democracy, according to Wilson, provides the legitimation that religion used to provide for public decisions. And the welfare state meets many of the needs that religious institutions used to meet. Well, is this wholly true?
I think we have to ask the question. My experience as a legislator, such as it is, has shown that simply counting heads is a very unsafe way of making certain decisions, particularly where there are decisions about the integrity of personal life at its earliest stages, at later stages, about the dignity of the human person at all stages. You need to invoke principles other than simply that the majority must be right. Similarly, the welfare state has been shown to be very limited, in fact, in what it can provide. But certainly, where significance for life is concerned, it can do almost nothing. A well-known psychiatrist said in Britain recently that he could prescribe people Prozac, but he couldn't give them meaning in life. On questions of relationships, how to direct one's life and one's career and so on, the welfare state has almost nothing to say or to contribute. And even in the areas where it has, because of economic reasons, there is backpedaling, furious backpedaling going on, certainly in countries like Britain. I'm sure this is also true of Canada. So the thesis that religion no longer provides that cohesive force has not been proved, as far as I'm concerned. However, for our purposes tonight, we have to note also another side to religion, which is not the glue that sticks society together, not that which provides cohesion for one society or another, but the dimension of religion which we might call the prophetic, which enables people to stand over and against the direction that a particular society may be taking, that helps the poor to stand up to the rich, the oppressed to free themselves from their oppressors, for the individual to be noticed in relation to the community. And this prophetic dimension, where that is concerned, the so-called Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, of course, display this side of religion quite clearly. And we will return to that, of course, in a moment. But I think it may be worth saying that this dimension of religion is not limited to Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. It can also be found in other traditions. Buddhism is, for instance, a many-faceted faith. But one way of understanding the emergence of Buddhism in ancient India is that of a very radical critique of the caste system. So as a social movement that was counter-caste. This is also true much later on of Sikhism, for instance. And even within Hinduism, there have been movements like Bhakti that have challenged the rigidity of the caste system. So we can see that this dimension is present also in these other traditions. Now, you may by now be saying that I am trying to idealize religion. I'm presenting to you the positive side. But what about the dark side? What about the downside? What about the charge that religion is responsible for evil, that it causes much suffering, and that it is behind so much of the conflict that there is in our world today? And before we go any further, I think it is as well to admit this, to say, yes, there is a dark side to religion, there is a negative side, to be honest about it. I was in Bosnia during the civil war there, and I had gone there on behalf of Christian Aid. I don't know if people know about Christian Aid here, but it is the major church's relief and development agency in Britain. And I went there to see if Christian Aid and Islamic Relief could work together to deliver supplies to people in that very difficult situation, regardless of confession. In fact, because the communities were so sharply divided at the time, our mission was only very partially successful. However, being there, I realized how religion had become entangled with the most pernicious kind of chauvinistic nationalism. And how much that contributed to that tragic conflict at the time. But of course, it is not only in the Balkans. Who would have thought that in post-Gandhian India that there would be so much communal violence? Hindu-Muslim, Hindu-Christian, against the Dalit particularly, as they have sought to assert their identity. Many other examples can, of course, be given of religion going wrong. We will, whether we like it or not, have to discuss certain aspects of radical Islamism as it has arisen in the Muslim world, and that again is an example of how religion can exhibit this down or negative side to it. However, it has to be said that if religion can and does go wrong, then in this it is no different from many other aspects of human life. Patriotism can go wrong, can't it? I mean, patriotism is a good thing. You've got Remembrance Sunday coming up, and I see all these wonderful poppies that you wear, which seem superior to me to the English poppy. Maybe the weather. But patriotism can go wrong. It can become chauvinistic, inward-looking, racist, all of those things that we understand. Human love can go wrong. What a wonderful thing love is between parents and children, husband and wife. But when it goes wrong, my goodness, it causes havoc, doesn't it? And all of us in one way or another have experience of love going right, but also love going wrong. So if religion can and does go wrong, all I'm saying is it's not unique in this. There are other aspects also of the human experience that can and do go wrong. It is also true, of course, that if you look at the last 100 years of human history, for instance, that many of the major conflicts that there have been in our world have not had religion as a significant dimension to them. Think of National Socialism, a secular fascist ideology. If it had a religious dimension, it was provided by a distorted form of Teutonic paganism. Stalinism, which arguably caused more suffering than the Nazis, is another secular ideology that led to a totalitarianism that the Russian people are only now grappling with and getting rid of. Mao Zedong's Cultural Revolution that tried to destroy every vestige of an ancient civilization. Pol Pot, even Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party in Iraq was a secular party, consciously modeling itself on the European fascism of the 1930s. So we accept that religion can be a dimension in conflict and suffering, But don't lay the blame on religion for these major conflicts and suffering that have been caused in most of the 20th century. Having said that, of course, I believe that it is true that religion should be accountable. And they should be accountable in two ways. First of all, they are accountable at the bar of world opinion. So it is quite right for the international community to point out where a religion in one way or another is the cause of suffering, of persecution, of conflict. Secondly, and this brings me to the point about dialogue, religions are also accountable to one another. I was for a very long time a great friend of a great Roman Catholic Canadian theologian, Professor Jean Tia, who must be known here, of course. Jean Tia used to rail against what he called kissy-kissy ecumenism. He was against it. Similarly, I am against kissy-kissy interfaith dialogue. You know, it's not about patting one another on the back and saying how wonderful we are, but precisely to examine the difficult questions between us and to hold one another accountable. When people say to me, as they do sometimes, Bishop, this is an internal matter for our faith, let us sort it out. Well, I'm afraid this is no longer an option in our world, if it ever was. We have to be accountable to one another. Any cooperation between the different faiths arises from also from this sense of accountability. Now, in this matter, Islam and Christianity have a special responsibility. And the reason for this is that they are the two great missionary faiths of our times. They are spreading rapidly in many different parts of the world, and Christians are Muslim, and Muslims are finding themselves cheek by jowl with one another. One of the countries, thank you for that long list of countries that you mentioned, but and of course, who can mention them all, but one of the countries that I am involved in at present is Nigeria, where in the Middle Belt there is a relatively new situation of Christians and Muslims finding themselves cheek by jowl, which is resulting in tremendous conflict between these two communities. It is vital in our age, therefore, that Christians and Muslims should not only be engaged in dialogue, but that dialogue should be the locus for this accountability, this mutual accountability that I am talking about. When I became the Bishop of Raiwind in Pakistan, Raiwind is not particularly known for anything. It's a rural diocese, and it certainly wasn't known for its bishop. But it was known for one thing. It was and is the center of the International Islamic Missionary Movement. And every year they had a convention. Well, you might say, so what? But this convention, even then, I'm talking now about the 1980s, even then it drew 800,000 Muslim missionaries to it every year, every year. It's now even more. The present bishop tells me it's now over 1 million. And we had to decide how, as a small church, we could relate to this enormous reality on our doorstep. Well, there are all sorts of things I could say about that. But one of the things that we did say to the leaders of this movement was, look, we understand that you feel it is your responsibility to invite people to Islam, to exercise da'wah. At the same time, you must understand that we feel it is our duty to invite people to faith in Jesus Christ. We don't want any misunderstanding about this. But once that is clear, then we can consider how and to what extent we can work together for the good of the community in which we both find ourselves. And in a limited way, this did become possible. I do remember occasions when I went up into the pulpit, as I shall tomorrow at St. George's, God willing, and found that either the front pews or the back pews were populated by trainee Muslim missionaries. Perhaps they'd come to learn how to preach. More likely, how not to preach. Perhaps the congregation at St. George's also will discover tomorrow morning. The point is that this accountability is very important. But in this relationship, we do have enormous resources that are available to address the questions that confront us. And for most of the rest of the time that I have, I want to discuss how these resources have become available to us. And the first thing immediately to note is that there has never been a time when Jews, Christians, and Muslims have not been living with one another since the rise of Islam as a historical religion. They have always been living with one another, near one another, and sometimes this has been in relative peace, and at other times this has been in the context of bloody conflict. And we can learn from all of those situations. So when Muhammad, the Prophet of Islam, when he was a young man engaged in trade, his employer, who was a woman, of course, she would send him on trading missions. And when he went to countries like Syria, which was then, of course, a wholly Christian country, he came across Christians and the Christian faith. Indeed, in Muslim tradition, it is pointed out that the people who first noticed that there was something unusual about this young man were Christian monks. And they are given particular names in Islamic tradition and so on. Eventually, as is known, Muhammad, the Prophet of Islam, married his employer, Khadija, the first wife of the Prophet of Islam. It has been noticed, she was of course older than him, but it has been noticed that as long as he was married to her, he remained monogamous. And this has led people to ask whether Khadija was a Christian. Well, whether she was or not, it is certain that she had relatives who came from a Jewish Christian background. And one particular person who is named by Islamic tradition in this matter is Waraka bin Nawfil. Recognized in a very friendly and honorable way by Islamic tradition as having brought to the Prophet of Islam's attention the Christian and Jewish traditions. Now, of course, as you know, when Muhammad began his preaching in Mecca about the oneness of God, he was strenuously opposed by the inhabitants of Mecca. And the reason, of course, for this was that Mecca at that time, as many other places on the Arabian Peninsula, flourished because of the religious cults in that town, particularly the cults of the so-called daughters of Allah that the pagan Arabs believed in. And naturally, the preaching that God, there was only one God and he had no daughters was not very helpful for the celebration of these cults. Now, that for Christians here, that will remind you of something in the New Testament, won't it? You know, what does it remind you of? Who? Yes, Paul at Ephesus, the riot at Ephesus, and great is Diana of the Ephesians, and all that. Anyway, the point is that this opposition became a sort of persecution of the small community of the early Muslims. Muhammad himself had some family protection, but his many of his followers, a small number of followers, did not. And so he decided to send them into exile as refugees. This is the first hijrah, the first exile in Muslim history. But the point, of course, is that he sent them as refugees to the Christian empire of Abyssinia or Ethiopia. Here they were greeted by immigration officials. That's the lot of refugees, isn't it? Who interrogated them. Again, that's the lot of refugees. But this was theological interrogation. Among other things, the officials had been asked by the Ethiopian emperor, the Negus, to ask these early Muslims what they believed about two things. What they believed about Jesus and what they believed about his mother. These early Muslims said that they, their prophet had told them that Jesus was Word and Spirit of God, and that he had been born of a virgin. On that basis, they were given refuge in Abyssinia. Many of them never returned. Some did come back when Muhammad, the Prophet of Islam, moved from Mecca to Medina himself. When he moved to Medina, he became, of course, not only the spiritual leader of the community of those who had moved from Mecca, as well as the Medinans, as well as the refugees, not only their spiritual leader, but also a political and temporal ruler. And much, of course, stems from that. Muhammad became the temporal ruler of Medina, he promulgated quite soon afterwards something known as the Sahifat of Medina, the Constitution of Medina, which recognized the existence and the rights of the various communities that existed in Medina at that time, the Jews, some Christians, the pagan Arabs, and of course the newly arrived Muslims, as well as those people from Medina who had become Muslim. And these people were described as a single community, as a single ummah. The word ummah, which is now used almost exclusively to describe Muslims, was used in this plural context. Now, I say this not just for historical interest, but when people in different parts of the world say to me they want to create an Islamic state, my response often is, will it be like the first Islamic state? And if not, why not? But of course, it also has to be said that this state of affairs did not last for very long. Quite quickly, Muhammad and his community came into conflict with some of the other communities in and around Medina. And again, I mention this conflict not for the sake of it, but because it was a harbinger of the things to come and the things that have characterized Jewish, Christian, and Muslim relations in one way or another. Two of the very big and influential Jewish tribes in Medina, the Banu Nadir and the Banu Qaynuqa, were deprived of their possessions and exiled. The third and the biggest tribe, the Banu Qurayza, were not so lucky. After they'd been made to surrender, their males, one by one, were beheaded. The slaughter took a whole day. The women and children were sold into slavery. So, on the one hand, you have the constitution of Medina. On the other hand, you have this story. Then the Muslim forces besieged and finally conquered the very powerful Jewish fortress of the Khyber. Not the Khyber Pass, as it is in Pakistan today, but which is named after it, of course, but the Jewish fortress of the Khyber. However, and again, this has future implications, the community was not destroyed or exiled, but they were allowed to continue with their work, which was agriculture. They were very successful agriculturalists in a hostile environment. They were allowed to continue this work, provided they gave half of their produce as tribute to the Muslims. Again, as I say, this became very significant in the future, which I will come to in just a moment. With the Christians, the relationships were somewhat different. The quite influential kingdom of Najran, the Christian community in Najran, the Prophet invited their leaders, mainly, of course, bishops, but also political leaders, to negotiate a treaty with him. They were invited to Medina, and they were lodged in the Prophet's mosque, lodged there, and allowed to celebrate the divine liturgy in the Prophet's mosque whilst they were negotiating a treaty with him. Again, I say this because today, if you and I, if you are a Christian or a non-Muslim, if you attempted to go to Medina, you would be confronted with notices warning you that you do so at the risk of your life. But that is not how it happened then. Again, the negotiations began with a theological prologue. The Christians of Najran wanted to know what Muhammad believed about Jesus. And Muhammad again said he believed that Jesus was Word and Spirit of God and was born of a virgin. The Christians of Najran, however, were not as easily put off. Perhaps they were not in so much need as the Ethiopians had been of accommodating these refugees. So they persisted with their questions, and they said, yes, but is he the Son of God? Muhammad had, as you know, in his preaching at Mecca, denied that Allah could have daughters. So how could he now say that after all he had a son? So he said, no, he is not the Son of God. Well, that's become a standard Muslim position, as you know. So the Christians then said, well, if he was born of a virgin, whose son is he then? Now, this is more easily understood in a language like Arabic, where people are usually described as somebody's son. So, Abdullah ibn Saud, Abdullah the son of Saud, or indeed Osama bin Laden, Osama the son of Laden. So, whose son was Jesus, they asked. Muslim tradition tells us that the Prophet of Islam did not give an answer to this question at the time. But later on, in the Quran, there are two answers to this question. One is that Jesus is Isa ibn Maryam, Jesus the son of Mary. And it is very interesting because this title, Jesus was called son of Mary in Jewish Christian polemic as a kind of insult. That is to say, you know, you couldn't say anything safely about who his father was. And it is to Islam's credit, I think we have to say, that it changed what was an insult into a title of honor. So when Muslims say he's Jesus, the son of Mary, they don't mean it as an insult, but to recognize that he was born of the Virgin. The other response is a counter question in the Quran, which is, well, whose son was Adam then? And just as the Quran says, just as God created Adam out of clay, so he created Jesus in Mary's womb by casting his word into her. Because God, this is a formula in the Quran that occurs again and again, God says, be and it is, kun fayakun. Anyway, although there was not complete agreement between the Muslims and the Christians on these matters, it was thought there was enough to conclude a treaty. And once again, concluding a treaty became a way of accommodating relations between Muslims and Christians. On the Prophet's death, and very soon afterwards, Islam spread, as you know, very rapidly throughout the world. So within a few years of his death, it had reduced the Christian Middle East. One by one the cities fell, and it is now for us almost impossible to imagine that the center of the Christian world at that time was not Europe. Pope Benedict notwithstanding. It was actually the center of the Christian world was the Middle East. The great Christian cities were Alexandria, Damascus, Jerusalem, Constantinople. Paris and London, and Rome had been thought of, but not much else. One by one, these cities fell, abandoned by the Byzantine garrisons, and forced to surrender. Damascus surrendered peacefully. The family that opened the gates of Damascus for the Muslim armies was the family Al-Mansur. You may say, well, what's so special about that? Well, the family Al-Mansur was the family of the man who was to be Saint John of Damascus, who himself held high office under the Umayyad caliphs before he gave it up to be a monk in Palestine. Jerusalem was surrendered to the Caliph Omar by the Patriarch Sophronius, who invited him to pray in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Omar declined on the grounds that if he did so, the Muslims would use it as an excuse to turn the church into a mosque. So he prayed outside, and if you've been to Jerusalem, you will know that the Mosque of Omar was built, has been built on the site where he prayed. Egypt, similarly, after some armed conflict, was deserted, and it was particularly the treachery of the clergy that resulted in the capitulation of Egypt to the Muslims. And the progress continued. The Persian Empire fell. Islam arrived on the shores of the Indus in the east, and in the west, North Africa, and eventually the Iberian Peninsula itself. Now, you know about these things, but there are certain issues that arise from this expansion that are important for us today. As the Muslims conquered these countries, they were at first, and for some time, a small minority. The majority of their subjects were Christians and Jews, and in the Persian Empire, Zoroastrians. Later on, also Buddhists and Hindus, of course. And a way had to be found of accommodating this diversity. So a number of things happened which need to be noted for the sake of their relevance for today. The first is, and this has to be said, however difficult it may be, that some communities, Christian, Jewish, Zoroastrian, were simply destroyed. So what had happened to the Banu Qurayza in Medina was repeated elsewhere. That's why I mentioned it in the first place. Khalid bin Walid, the great Muslim general, who was responsible for many of the conquests, was actually disciplined by the Caliph Umar for needlessly destroying, for example, Christian communities. Others were dispersed, not allowed to remain in their homes. Again, that resembles what happened to the Banu Nadir and the Banu Kanuka. You remember them? The tribes that were exiled. Now, a tradition was discovered of the Prophet that Arabia, that means to say the peninsula, should have only one religion. And so the Christians and the Jews of Arabia were expelled. Muhammad did not expel them. He concluded treaties with some of them, as we have seen. But now they were expelled. And the Jewish communities went mainly to the region of Jericho and settled there. And the Christians went to Iraq. And of course, that remained the case until modern times and the advent of petroleum and all of that, that there were no Christians and Jews on the Arabian Peninsula for all that time. There was destruction, there was dispersal. There was also, to accommodate this diversity, the Muslims developed the system that came to be known as the Dhimma, D-H-I-M-M-A, in some languages pronounced Zimma. The word means responsibility. That is to say, the Muslims assumed responsibility for the safety of Christians and Jews at first, later on Zoroastrians, then later on other faiths, for their safety, provided they agreed not to claim equality with Muslims. Muslim scholars themselves recognize that the Sharia, the law of Islam, recognizes three kinds of inequality. The inequality between Muslim and non-Muslim, between men and women, and between slave and free. So this was one manifestation of structured inequality. Now, you may say that the Dhimma was an advance, in the sense that it tolerated even the existence of such people within the Islamic domains. And to some extent, this is so. But we must not be ignorant of the negative side of the Dhimma. This tolerance, if you like, if you can call it that, was bought at a very high price. So the Dhimmis, as they were known, could not, of course, serve in the armed forces. They could not hold a high political office because they could not lead the community in prayer. You see, that was the reason why they were excluded from leadership. They could maintain their churches and synagogues and with permission repair them, but they could not build new ones. They could not have any external symbol of their religion on their churches and synagogues. The churches and synagogues could not be such that they seemed grander than the mosque in any particular area. The houses of Christians and Jews and Zoroastrians had to be more modest than Muslim houses. They could ride donkeys but not horses. They had to wear a special dress. They had to give way to the Muslims in the street. And when they paid the special tax, the poll tax, that was levied on them simply for their religion, it had to be done in such a way that showed their humiliation. This was usually a blow on the neck by the person who was receiving the tax, but it took other forms as well. So let no one tell you that this tolerance that was bought by the Dhimma was something that was easy for anybody. However, even in spite of these very restrictive conditions, the Christians and also the Jews were engaged very actively in dialogue, what we call today interfaith dialogue, with the Muslims. So between the 7th and the 9th centuries, there are 9 Christian apologists of the first rank in the Muslim world, writing in Arabic, sometimes also in Syriac and Greek. John of Damascus is himself an example of this. You know, in the West, John's theological and ascetical writings are known, but he is also the author of a very important dialogue with Muslims, which is very instructive because he assumes, for example, that Muslims and Christians are talking about the same God, but that their understanding of this God is quite different. He uses the Quran in explaining the significance of Jesus Christ to Muslims and so on. This was also true of the other apologists. For instance, the Caliph Mehdi, the father of Harun al-Rashid and Mamun al-Rashid, the great Abbasi caliphs, he had at his court the Nestorian patriarch Timothy. And we have a number of his dialogues translated and published by the Christian Study Center in Rawalpindi in Pakistan, which show the kind of discussion that took place between Muslims and Christians, the respect shown by the patriarch to the caliph, the very frank nature of the discussion, and the sort of cordial atmosphere in which it all happened in that particular setting, situation. Then there was the role of Christians and Jews in the development of what came to be called Islamic civilization. You see, people have often said, how did these nomadic people from the desert suddenly develop this huge intellectual and material and literary and artistic civilization? How did it happen? Well, to some extent it happened because they wanted it to happen. But the means very often were Jews, Christians and Zoroastrians. So in the development, for example, of the caliphate, many of the features of governance were taken from the Persians. I'll come back to that in a moment. Architecturally and in terms of development of law even, Byzantium provided a model for the development of Islamic civilization. But there is one area that I just want to mention, because we are in a university and it says here it's not just French and English and Arabic, but you've also got Latin here, that God is the Lord of all knowledge. Well, this is crucial because it is often said that the West reacquired Hellenistic knowledge from the Muslims. This is to a very great extent true. Aquinas, in his own writings, is constantly dealing with and has on the horizon the Islamic philosophers. But the question is, how did the Muslims get it? How did they receive Hellenistic learning? This question is hardly ever asked in the academy. The answer is they got it mainly from Christian clergy. I mean, Christian clergy are of some use. they'll be glad to hear. I've run out of this. What did you say it was?
Gatorade.
Very nice, but I'm now down to water. What happened was that the schools of translation that were established by the caliphs were staffed almost entirely by Oriental Christian clergy from the different churches. Just to give you one example, there was a father and son team, Nestorians in this case, Hunayn ibn Ishaq, and the son was known as Ishaq ibn Hunayn. Not surprising. Between them, they translated the entire medical corpus of the Greeks into Arabic. The father was a better Greek scholar and translated into Syriac. The son was better at Arabic and so translated from the Syriac into Arabic. That is how Hellenistic learning, philosophy, theology, medicine came into Muslim hands. Of course, they commented on it and improved it in one way or another. And it was then transmitted to Western Europe in two ways. One was through Jewish traders. That is why Islamic names in medieval Europe were in an Hebraic form. So Ibn Rushd became Averroes. Ibn Sina became Avicenna, and so on. You know what happens to B's and V's in Hebrew. And that shows how the transmission actually occurred. The other main way was through the Arabic-speaking Christian communities of Europe. There were large Arabic-speaking Christian communities in the Iberian Peninsula. That is from where you get the word Moz Arabic. Moz Arabic is a corruption of the Arabic word Mustarib. Mustarib means people who have become Arab. These Christians, of course, could read Arabic, but they were also in touch with monasteries in the rest of Western Europe and places of learning. And so the transmission took place through them. This is a very little known area of study, and I wish that there was more attention devoted to it. However, the point is that this feast of reason and flow of soul abruptly came to an end. And it came to an end for two main reasons. One was the Crusades. The Crusades were called by Pope Urban for a number of reasons. It wasn't just aggression against Islam or anything like that. There were some very serious reasons. One was that the Seljuk Turks, who had been newly converted to Islam, were preventing European pilgrims going to the Holy Land. And as you know, the Holy Land was in medieval times known as the Fifth Gospel, so that it explained to others what the four Gospels were about, the serious matter. Secondly, a caliph, Fatimi Caliph in Cairo, who had lost his mental balance, I think, destroyed the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, Al-Hakim. He also went on to destroy many Muslim holy places later on. But the destruction of the Holy Sepulchre caused enormous alarm in Europe. Thirdly, the Eastern Emperor, who was coming under increasing pressure from Muslim forces, directly appealed to the Pope for help. Those were the three reasons that occasioned the Crusades. Now, of course, there was much barbarity. The Crusaders lost their original vision and all of that. I don't want to go into that. That has to be recognized. But the barbarity and the greed was not all on one side. It was on every side. And more evidence is showing us that. I often say to my Muslim friends that the Crusades were not conducted only against the Muslims. There was a crusade, for example, against the Jews. There was a crusade against the Albigensian heretics. There was even a crusade against the Eastern Christians. The conquest by the Crusaders of Constantinople and the establishing of the Latin kingdom there arguably was a significant factor in its fall later on in 1453 to the Muslims. The Arab historian Amin Maalouf, in his book on the Crusades, tells us that arguably it was the Oriental Christians who suffered the most, because the Western Christians regarded them as heretics and the Muslims thought they were a fifth column. So they were caught in between. The other reason for the abrupt end of this flowering of Islamic civilization was, of course, the arrival of the Mongols. See, throughout the centuries, people had been coming down from the steppes of Central Asia into the Middle East and also into parts of Europe. The Turks themselves. But when the Mongols arrived, they caused a sort of devastation that had not really been seen before. City after city was destroyed in India, in the Middle East, in Europe. In 1258, the Mongols conquered and devastated the city of Baghdad. The devastation was such that the Persian poet Sa'di, looking at what had happened, says, "Muhammad, if you are to come on Judgment Day, come now, because this is Judgment Day." There were some among the Mongols, particularly their wives, who were Nestorian Christians. So the Nestorian community in Baghdad was not as badly treated. There were some among the Mongols who were Shia. So the Shia community was not as badly treated. But it was the Sunnis who caught the worst of the excesses of the Mongols. Now again, this is a historical fact, but it serves to show that there is nothing new under the sun. The present conflict involving Shia and Sunni and Christian in Iraq goes back a very long way. The result of the Mongol invasion was the end of Arab supremacy in the Muslim world until the modern period. What happened now was that various Turkish tribes began to be ascendant, and eventually a very obscure Turkish tribe called the Osmanli became dominant and the founders therefore of the Ottoman Empire. Lots of things can be said about the Ottomans, but I just want to refer to two. One is that the Ottomans took the dhimma, you remember the dhimma, the way of accommodating non-Muslims, and refined it by using a pre-Islamic Persian idea called the millat system to govern a vast empire that stretched from the Balkans right down to Egypt and Palestine, Iraq, and many other places in the Middle East. What this meant was that the Ottomans governed by giving maximum autonomy to ethnic or ethno-religious communities in terms of their own laws to a very great extent, autonomy in trade, autonomy in their internal affairs. And that was how they managed to govern such a vast area for so many centuries. But of course, the point is that wherever the Ottomans have been, ethno-religious communities have a very high sense of their identity. This is the key to the conflict in the Balkans, for instance. There will never be a solution in the former Yugoslavia that is unitary, because the communities are too highly identified in particular ways. This is also true of Iraq. I mean, no unitary solution in Iraq will work because the communities are used to these high levels of autonomy. And the only solution that can be found in the end is some sort of confederal solution if unity is to be maintained at all. The other thing about the Ottomans that is worth mentioning is that they used the system of tribute that was inherent in the dhimma to include not just money but people. So there was a levy called the devshirme on families, for example in the Balkans, to supply children to the Ottomans to be taken away and trained to be elite forces or elite civil servants. That system, of course, defines relationships between Muslims and Christians in the Balkans, certainly. Now, because of Western pressure on the Ottomans in the 19th century, the caliphs began to issue a succession of edicts called firmans, which at first eased and then eventually abolished the dhimma. For the first time since the rise of Islam, there was no longer any dhimma, and Muslims, Christians and Jews found themselves equal citizens. Because of the rise of Zionism in European Jewry, Oriental Jews had also become influenced by it and did not take too much part in this new dispensation, because their eyes were already fixed on a Zionist future. But Christians certainly did. For instance, this state of affairs resulted in the rise of what is known as Arab nationalism, or the Nahda. In the Nahda, the articulation of the Nahda, the Arab Christians played a disproportionate part. Arab nationalism recognized Arab identity in terms of language and history and culture. And although Islam was supposed to be a part of all of this, it was not a dominant part. There is a long list of Christian Arab nationalists. Constantine Zorak, Anton Farah, Boutros Ghali, the ancestor of the present Boutros Ghali, and of course Michel Aflaq, the founder of the Ba'ath Party himself, who lived his last years in Iraq when Saddam Hussein was president. And even when Saddam was at the height of his power, precedence on ceremonial occasions was always given to Aflaq. The Ottomans lost all of their domains. They lost the Balkans, they had lost Greece very early on in the 19th century. They lost the Arab world in the earlier part of the 20th century, and so what was left now was Turkey. And this gave rise to Turkish nationalism, as you might expect. Once again, founded on Turkish culture and language, and not so much on religion, though again the role of Islam was to some extent recognized. And when we think about Turkey today and its relationship, for instance, with its Kurdish minority and other minorities, including the Christians, we have to understand that this attitude has come about because the Turks have been pushed back on all sides into Turkey. And so their understanding has become Turkey for the Turks. Where else are we going to go? If you then start negotiating with other communities, well, maybe even that will go. I mean, I'm not trying to excuse Turkish behavior vis-a-vis minorities, but this is the reason for it. And then, of course, we had the emergence of Indian Muslim nationalism, which resulted in the birth of Pakistan. Again, the Indian Muslim nationalists were not theocrats. Religion was not the first thing in their minds, but culture and lifestyle and the freedom to order the lives of the community without hindrance. I mean, those were the things that drove the Muslim nationalists to demand the creation of Pakistan. The Christians in Pakistan, and some of your ancestors, Rebecca, were also involved in this, supported the creation of that country on the grounds that the Muslims would be in a minority in India would treat other minorities well. Well, that proved, of course, to be a mistaken presupposition, an honorable one, but a mistaken one. What had been a nationalist movement gradually and eventually gave rise to a theocratic state. And that is actually what happened. Now, the question is, why did nationalism, not only in Pakistan but in a whole number of other countries, give way to what we may call Islamism of one kind or another? What were the reasons? The first reason undoubtedly is the experience of colonialism and of powerlessness. The Islamists, reformers are constantly accusing the nationalists of being puppets of the West, of deriving their political ideas from Western ideas. And to a great extent, you know, we can say this is true. Not only colonialism, but also neo-colonialism. In the 1950s, the Western powers, particularly Britain, destabilized and eventually overthrew the moderately socialist government of Prime Minister Mossadegh in Iran because it would not give them oil concessions. Well, what was sown in the overthrow of Mossadegh was reaped in the Islamic Revolution of 1978-79. In the 1980s, late 70s and 80s, after the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, I was working in the area at the time, and the Western powers, with the collusion of the intelligence services in Pakistan, identified, trained, financed, and armed the most dubious extremist groups with a view to the overthrow of the Soviet-backed regime in Afghanistan. And it was said clearly at the time that the idea was to make Afghanistan the Vietnam of the Soviet Union. And of course they succeeded in doing this, but at what cost? The cost was the birth of an international Islamic terrorist movement. That was the cost. To such an extent that in many languages in the Muslim world, the word for terrorist has now become Afghan. You know, there's a perfectly good word for terror, for a terrorist in Arabic, Irhabi, but popularly people just say Afghan, not meaning an inhabitant of Afghanistan, but somebody who's been radicalized on the killing fields of that part of the world. That was the cost. Thirdly, Islamism flourished because of the corruption of Muslim elites. Again and again, the reformers point out how their rulers, the powerful people, economically and politically, are corrupt. And again, there is a great deal of justice in what they have said. The sort of levels of corruption are almost unbelievable. And then also, and finally, in this respect, the failure of both capitalism and the command economy socialist model in the Muslim world. This was command economy socialism was tried in countries like Syria and Egypt, for instance, and it produced the usual results. Shoddy goods in the shops, overproduction of things that nobody wanted to buy, hidden unemployment, you know, the litany is very long, I'm afraid. But what the effect of it was to make the poor poorer and even the rich poorer. But capitalism also failed. I was working in Lahore in the middle of the 1980s, and I was at a reception where I was talking to a World Bank official, and he said to me quite plainly, he said, look, we only know the rich. We don't know the poor. We know the rich, and so we work with the rich. We hope that what we do with the rich has some effect on the poor. Well, I was working with the very poor at that time, bonded labor in the brick kilns, and again, your uncle knows a lot about that, Rebecca. And I said to this World Bank official, I said, well, I couldn't see much sign of what they were doing with the rich trickling down to these people. And admittedly, the World Bank has changed its policies in that respect and are now much more aware of the poor. But that is how it was. In Iran, the Shah was building Switzerland in North Tehran. You know that. And where did the revolution begin? In South Tehran, where the slums were, and the inhabitants of which were not allowed even to go to North Tehran. So, of course, they marched from South Tehran to North Tehran, took their oppressors, and hung them by the lamppost. That is what happened. Now, I just thank you for your patience. I just want to finish by identifying a few issues that we may want to discuss. I think one of the things that the rise of radical Islamism has shown us is that the Westphalian consensus that religion should be kept out of public life, that consensus is dead. The question now is not whether religion should have any role in public life, but what kind of role it should have. Secondly, what is the relationship of religion to democracy? In fact, democracy has arisen only in those societies that have emerged from the Judeo-Christian tradition. And the question is, can other societies also provide a rationale from their own background for democracy? The jury is out on this question at the moment, but it is a question that has to be asked. Thirdly, what is the relationship of religion to law? In Western societies, public law has, of course, been based on the Judeo-Christian tradition, but it has also acquired an autonomy from particular religious communities, a proper autonomy, so that we can say there is only one law for all. And the question is whether the religious law of particular communities can now be accommodated in terms of public law in the West. And this has been urged by prominent Christian religious leaders and also by prominent leaders in the legal profession. My own view is, which I can develop later if you wish, that such a recognition, for example, of Sharia in terms of public law in the West would be a terrible mistake. And I can explain to you later on why I believe that. There is the question also of reciprocity. You know, Christians understandably feel that because there are mosques in Toronto, is there a mosque in Ottawa? I'm sure there must be. You know, why should there not be churches in Riyadh or Jeddah or Sana'a or wherever it might be? I was asking an Iranian official whether any new Christian churches had been built in Iran since the Islamic Revolution, because he'd been claiming that there was complete religious freedom in Iran. He said, well, no, because the Christians don't need them. So I said, well, shouldn't you let the Christians decide that? So reciprocity is a question. However, I think we have to be careful about not making it sound like tit for tat. And the way in which I believe through dialogue that reciprocity should be treated, stated properly, is to say that reciprocity is about owning and promoting fundamental freedoms on all sides, wherever the partners in dialogue have influence and power. That is how reciprocity ought to be stated as far as international affairs are concerned. Now, there are things also to say about the rise of terrorist movements and what has given birth to them, but maybe that will come out in the discussion. I've gone on for long enough, and maybe the chairman will permit you to stand and turn around and talk to one another before we have questions and comments. Thank you very much for your attention.